It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Steelers are 3-0, their best start since the 2010 season, and they won't have a chance to make it 4-0 Sunday in Nashville against Tennessee. That's because of a coronavirus outbreak that's affected at least 6 staff members and 4 players for the Tennessee Titans. Joining us now is Sean Gentile, senior writer for The Athletic. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Kevin, glad to be back.
All right, Sean. Tuesday, the NFL said the game was on for Sunday. Then we get word Wednesday it was postponed. What happened?
That's a great question. We had one more positive test from a Titans player that we found out about on Wednesday morning. A couple hours later, ESPN first reports, and then the NFL confirms that the game got pushed back to Monday or Tuesday. I think what we've got here is that they want to have a few more days of test results rolling in and then just kind of take it as it comes. But yeah, not a ton has changed since yesterday. I think they, you know, were just trying to buy some time and maybe buy another day or two before having to make the decision. But yeah, we're going to have maybe Monday night football and maybe Tuesday night football.
Is this an effort to make it more fair for the Tennessee Titans, because they were being shut down from their facilities until Saturday? They really couldn't practice. So is this to sort of balance it out a little bit?
I think so. Best case scenario for the Titans were that they were going to miss an entire week of practice. You make it to Saturday, you go through your walkthrough, which is typically the way NFL teams operate, and then you have a game on Sunday. That's a tough task. I don't think any NFL team would prefer that scenario if the shoe were on the other foot. So yeah, I think that's part of it. You know, they're going to have Saturday and Sunday and maybe Monday to practice. If they play on Tuesday night, that would actually make it a lot more similar schedule-wise to a Thursday night football where you have 3 or 4 days of practice beforehand. So yeah, I think that's part of it. I think it's the NFL, you know, trying to make it as close to a normal game as possible, right? And if you have a team that misses a week of practice and only has one day of walkthrough beforehand, that's certainly not a normal week. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it, is trying to make it as fair as possible to a team that's in kind of a tough situation.
Not to be cynical, this game was scheduled for 1 o'clock Sunday. Now the NFL has another primetime game.
Yeah, it's funny. You try to figure out, is it going to be on NFL Network? Is it going to be on CBS? You know, does ESPN swoop in? What happens? I'm sure the NFL is not going to have a problem if it's Tuesday night. You just dominate another night of the sports schedule, right? So yeah, I'm sure they'd be fine with that. It's another day of football. It's another opportunity for the NFL to kind of dominate the conversation, and that's what they're all about. So yeah, I'm sure they're very happy on Park Avenue right now.
So the NFL has been fairly lucky, fairly fortunate, not playing in a bubble like the NHL did, like the NBA is doing. They've been pretty fortunate that this is the first game that's been affected.
Absolutely. It's a pretty impressive feat of contact tracing, and then you're incorporating technology too into the way they go about this. You have everybody in the facility outside of the media is wearing tracker bracelets so they know what rooms they're in and who they're in the rooms with. I mean, it's a major, major undertaking, and it doesn't surprise me that the NFL was prepared for this. Say what you will about them, there's certainly plenty of negative things and a lot of criticism that they deserve. But from the planning end of things, you know, they had 4 months or 5 months of runway for this. They decided it was going to work, and for the most part, it has.
The coronavirus cases within the Tennessee organization, they come at a time when the Steelers are hoping to get some fans in the stands for their next home game, which is October 11th. And Pitt's athletic director, Heather Like, has said she hopes to have fans at Heinz Field on Saturday against North Carolina State. So what's the process? What are you hearing? It's all up to the state health secretary, Dr. Levine, right?
Absolutely. And it shows you what a different world college football is too. I mean, there's just been such a desire and such a movement starting out in the SEC, because as the Southeastern Conference goes, typically the rest of college football follows. But you have 25,000 fans in the seats at LSU, and you have fans at Georgia and Florida. So I think you know, when you're talking about all these different states with all these different regulations, the look in college football has certainly been strange. But yeah, even here, can you imagine in late May or June saying that there's going to be actual fans watching football at Heinz Field? It seems like that's, if Pitt, you know, again, it's not their call, but we're tracking towards seeing that. And it's a wild thought given where we were a few months ago.
Sean Gentile is a senior writer for The Athletic. Thanks, Sean.
Certainly, Kevin.
It's a confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Biden for president. Trump Pence. Make America great again. A few words taking up a small bit of real estate on someone's lawn. It doesn't seem like a lot, but in some parts of the state, a yard sign is a signal to a neighbor that it's safe to express their political views. Jeff Eggleston is a Democratic state committee member from Warren County who is crisscrossing the state distributing Biden signs. Jeff, first off, tell me how many signs you've distributed thus far.
I have to check the totals, but I mean, we're well over 120,000 in the state overall, and that's with 60-plus counties participating. When we started, I would have been happy with like 6,000 or 10,000. And when we reached that number, I thought, oh, this is amazing. We're really making a difference. And then now it's just like every week we're putting out at least 5,000 signs. So it just keeps growing.
So there's this sentiment that signs don't vote, and the people who put signs in their yards are already committed voters. So why signs?
Well, it's kind of a funny thing because I think that this topic has so many layers to it that speak to the rural-urban divide and the difference in strategy and ideology. In an urban environment, for many people, many of them don't have yards, or there isn't much space to place signs. And then plus the voters are really concentrated. So, you know, going door to door and doing canvassing and stuff like that is a way more effective way to engage people. You know, in a rural community, like in our area, I mean, we have one town that has 8,000 people in it, and everybody else is spread apart. Like, if you wanted to canvass or go door to door, it would be impossible. What do you do to engage voters? And I think it's something that's kind of a misnomer that yard signs don't vote. Out here, especially when you have areas where you're in the minority, when you see those signs out, there's a high level of social proof there that the campaign's engaged with your community, that you're not alone, that you're not there by yourself. And when people don't see them, in their minds, the campaign's not doing anything. You're not engaging them. And the other thing you have is a lot of these folks aren't on social media maybe at the same rate. But I mean, I know like both campaigns, you know, the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign have dumped a massive amount of money into, you know, YouTube and, you know, television advertising and stuff like that. So I think that there's a challenge there in rural communities to try to engage voters. And then the last thing is just the issue of COVID with the coronavirus and the shutdowns and everything else. Even if you were going to go door to door for much of this year, it's just not possible, you know, and especially in our area that, I mean, there's so many folks that are, you know, seniors that have health issues. They're hyper concerned about getting sick. And the last thing you want to do is knock on their door, even if you have a mask and try to engage them. So all of those things kind of build to this, what has happened this year with us, which is, The yard sign is the easiest way in a contactless environment to show your support and campaign and promote your candidate. You know, other than social media and some of the other stuff, it's very real for people to see those signs. And I mean, and I think that's why the response has been so huge. Everybody's been locked up, and this is a way for them to kind of express all of that. You know, anxiety, support, frustration with the current situation, you know, and I think that it's kind of a perfect storm. That's why it's turned out as well as it has, in my opinion.
You told the New York Times in a piece published in early September that you're doing this, quote, partly for therapy, end quote. Can you tell me what that means?
I get that question all the time because I've spent a lot of time on this, a lot of my own personal time and my family's time, and people will say, "Gosh, you've got to be crazy. Like, what's the matter with you?" You know, honestly, in 2016, I was sitting in the Democratic office at, 1 o'clock in the morning in November, just staring at the television set, waiting for somebody to come on the screen and say, "This isn't real." Like, "Oh, we fudged the numbers, Trump didn't win, blah 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 blah." And it never happened. And I left that office and went home. My wife and I went to bed, and that night I very distinctly remember saying to myself that in 2020, in the next 4 years, I'm not going to leave anything on the table. It's too important, because I was like everybody else. I mean, in 2016, I thought there was no way that Trump could win. It just didn't seem possible that someone of that character could win an election in the United States. And I realized afterwards that I had not really committed to winning. I hadn't really, done everything I could. And so this time around, I just wanted to, I think that's part of the reason where the therapy comes in, is that I feel like I'm doing penance, or I'm making amends for not putting enough on the table in 2016, and riding the bench maybe more than I should have. And I think that the thing is I can say pretty, I feel pretty good that on November 3rd, even if it doesn't work out the way I'd like it to, that I can say that I've done everything I could, like, at least for in my little part of the world. So.
So I know that merchandise is good because it signals to voters, it can signal enthusiasm and things like that, but do you really think it can make a difference in how someone votes?
It seems silly, and it's almost impossible to quantify the actual impact. Like, and this is the problem that I think a lot of campaign professionals have, is like there's not a number they can associate to it, but there's anecdotal, emotional evidence that people are that were normally, kicking and screaming to try to be dragged through a campaign are pumped up and want to put this stuff out, want to show how they feel about their candidate, and want to promote them and share them with the world. And I think that there's an unquantifiable positive, element to that it's really hard to justify, really hard to explain, but when you see it, you know what it is. I mean, like, as an example, I've talked to people in counties, like, for instance, in the Northeast, where, during 2016, they had to fight to put out 1,000 signs. And in this election, they've already put out 10,000, and they need more. I get it that a lot of those people that are putting signs in the yards were going to vote for that candidate anyway, but it's just that social proof is just huge, especially in rural communities that are in many cases majority Republican.
Jeff Eggleston is a Democratic State Committee member from Warren County. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Supreme Court has been thrust into the political spotlight following the recent death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. For our Split Ticket series, we're looking at how issues like this influence voters' choices. And 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports the fight over Ginsburg's replacement underscores the tensions of a divisive election year.
Before Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, Republican Mary Henze wanted her to retire.
Girlfriend, take a break. Like, you don't have much time left.
Mary's in her 50s, lives in Jefferson Hills, and has been on disability for about a decade. Mary believes President Trump's choice of conservative judge Amy Coney Barrett would protect gun rights and help overturn Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case that guaranteed the right to an abortion.
I hope and I pray that he gets the election and that we are able to put a conservative on the Supreme Court in order to overturn that decision. That would be God's hand at work.
Mary and other conservatives are excited about Trump's third Supreme Court pick, who has articulated anti-abortion and anti-LGBT stances. Republican Ed Swiklinski wants to see Barrett confirmed too, despite not knowing anything about her yet. He believes the best way to depoliticize the Supreme Court is to appoint conservatives.
Because they're going to be more apt to rule based on judicial law and being the umpire than to inserting themselves as well.
Ed is in his 40s, lives in Bethel Park, and works in information security. He supports Republican efforts to confirm Barrett before the election, even though they've drawn accusations of hypocrisy from Democrats. Back in 2016, Senate Republicans refused to confirm a Supreme Court nominee named by Barack Obama, saying voters should get to choose the president first. Ed's only criticism is that Republicans shouldn't have taken that position in the first place.
It would have been nice that the Republicans just said, look, we're in charge of the Senate. We get to decide what happens in the Senate, and it's politics. Election results have consequences.
But while Ed says Republicans should have never made that promise in 2016, Democrat Linda Bishop says they should live up to it now.
Now those same senators seem to think it's fine to confirm a justice the week before the election, and in fact, people are voting already. I think that's completely hypocritical, and I think it's a total affront to the American voters.
Linda's retired, lives in Mars, Pennsylvania, and spends much of her time doing grassroots organizing. She's also worried about how Barrett's appointment could impact the Affordable Care Act, which provides health care coverage to millions of Americans. Barrett has criticized the Supreme Court ruling which upheld the law.
To choose somebody that has such extreme and strong predispositions on that particular issue seems very unfair to the American people.
And like many Democrats, both Linda and progressive voter Savannah Henry are worried about abortion rights. Savannah's a junior at the University of Pittsburgh, where she's president of the Planned Parenthood Club. She says Barrett goes against a lot of what she stands for.
Because it's not just reproductive rights. Like, she's also, like, anti-LGBT. She's anti-immigration. She's anti-gun control. It's just, like, a lot of the things I care about, she's, like, really against.
She supported Bernie Sanders in the primary and has not been enthusiastic about Joe Biden. But she says Ginsburg's death has inspired her to be more active in the election. That's even more true now that the president has nominated Barrett.
She's, like, using all of the doors that have been opened through her from, like, feminists from the past. And then she's going in to, like, deny people the very things Ruth Bader Ginsburg fought so hard to provide to people.
Republican Mary Henze says the timing of Ginsburg's death is no coincidence.
Isn't it odd that it happens right before the election? And that it can be put through like this. I really believe that this is God saving grace into our judicial system.
The Senate is on track to confirm Barrett by Election Day. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm. where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.